Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books. Kia ora and welcome to another week of Bookends with Marianne Stone and the wonderful Morin Rout.
I'm not the only one that's wonderful here. We've got wonderful people on the program.
Oh, we do. We've got a great program for you. We're going to chat with Alan Rikers about the ever popular Bird of the Year competition. And for this, Morin and I have made a call.
We have.
You say it, Morin.
Well, we're going for the Nutupare, which is the rye bill. And it's one of the very endangered birds in New Zealand. And it hangs out a lot
in our beautiful braided rivers in Canterbury. So that's why we've chosen this one, Nutupare, Bird of the Year. And it's got a very cute, fluffy, pale breast and grey. It's gorgeous and a curved beak. A
very clever curved beak. So, yes. That's what we're going for.
And so Bird of the Year with Alan Rikers. And then I'm also speaking with the effervescent Sinead Corcoran-Dye about her sad but somehow hilarious book called It Nearly Killed Me, But I Love You, which is for all the mamas out there that aren't having a wonderful time first time round.
And there are quite a lot of them. And I'm talking about another tale of survival. I'm talking with Auckland visual artist and long-time supporter of the arts, Helen Shamroth, about the book she's put together telling the stories of her parents' survival of the Holocaust. It's been a long and quite tortuous path for Helen and her sister to make sense of what their parents went through, but it's a very moving and important story.
So there we have it. Everybody's struggling for survival one way or the other. Our New Zealand manu, the survivors and intergenerational trauma, and new mamas who are just trying to make it all work and make sense. This week on Bookends. Alan Rikers is an award-winning science, nature and climate change writer and podcast producer whose adventurous spirit and achievements are admirable, especially in one so young. She was a school friend of my daughter, so I'm allowed to say that. So it is an absolute pleasure to get to catch up and discuss her light-hearted book celebrating 20 years of Aotearoa's big-hearted Bird of the Year competition. Tēnā koe, Alan.
Kia ora. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, well, it is a delight. You've been with Forest and Bird for 3 years now, right? So your love of birds, though, it runs deeper than that. Tell us the Alan Rikers bird affinity story.
Yeah, my origins with birds. So I spent part of my childhood growing up on the Port Hills of Christchurch. And, I mean, Christchurch isn't particularly known as a bird lover's city, but we did have bellbirds in a reserve up there. And so I remember being aware of them and listening to them as a child, and also going up north of Auckland to visit my granddad and seeing all the different kinds of birds that were up there kind of really sparked an interest. But probably wasn't until maybe university time where I really sort of came back to that after being disinterested as a teenager and became fully immersed in the bird nerd world.
Okay, a bird nerd, a full bird nerd. Yeah. Good to hear. And so your work with Forest and Bird, has that been about bringing this book to fruition, or what else is your work with Forest and Bird involve?
Yeah, so I started working for Forest and Bird in 2022 in their comms team, just a sort of a part-time role. And what my main project was really Bird of the Year. So I was part of the very small team who delivers the big competition, which was awesome for me because it was something that I had admired and sort of participated in as a voter and someone on the internet. So got to work on the competition for a couple of years, and then it was after 2023, the competition that really went nuts.
Wow.
With John Oliver.
Yeah.
That Forest and Bird was approached by Penguin Random House, who said, "We think a Bird of the Year book would be a neat idea." And we sort of were looking ahead to the 20th anniversary of Bird of the Year, and we're like, well, that would be a great opportunity to have a book and go back over the history. And with my experience leading a couple of Bird of the Year competitions and then also experience writing long-form features for magazines, felt that I was the right person to write this, which was very flattering and very cool.
Yeah, and you have done a beautiful job. The book has two sections, right? It's got the history of the comp and then the best feathered friend forever profiles, which is a cool concept. So just talk to us a little bit about that, the profiles, the best feathered friend forever.
Yeah. So typically in Bird of the Year, there's about 70-ish birds that are candidates. And so these profiles essentially go over 80 birds and one bat who have featured in Bird of the Year over the years. And they are, it's not like a field guide for birds. So these are really kind of snippets which might talk about the natural history and the ecology of the birds, but also about the people who really love them and who have campaigned for them in Bird of the Year or who are working on the ground to save them. So there's a real variety and mix in the profiles of these birds.
Yeah, that it's beautiful in that way, really entertaining in that way. And the research is, of course, impeccable. There is then in the first section as well, so much great colloquial fun and recent New Zealand cultural history to recall along the way for the competition, isn't there? Can you tell us, have you got a favourite anecdote? I know it's really hard. I was going to say, you know, I just love that John Oliver pitch for the grebe. It was magical to see the grebe going off like that, off the back of that. So you're not allowed to talk about that one because it's just too obvious. Is there, from all of the other anecdotes, anything that really just speaks to your heart or tickled your funny bone?
Oh, a lot. I think that one that did stand out to me was one of the early voting scandals, which I believe was in 2015. And that was when there was an unusual spike recorded for the North Island kōkako. And the campaign manager at the time, who was a teenager himself, contacted the Forest and Bird and said, "Oh, I've just noticed it's gone up a lot in a very short space of time. I'm just telling you, that wasn't me." And they looked into it and they found that all of these votes had come from a single business email, or, you know, emails associated with a business. And they called this business up and said, "Hey, what's going on?" And it turned out it was the business owner's teenage children who had co-opted his email address, and because they love the kōkako so much, had put in all of these votes, and it's only one vote per person. And I just thought that was such a funny moment because it was really when they decided to own the voter fraud. Forest and Bird decided to own this and put it out as like a news story, so it got picked up by all these media organisations. And then it was sort of quite a heartwarming thing because these teenagers then got to go out into the bush with a Forest and Bird project and go and find kōkako in the wild.
So. Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. There's just endless stories, aren't there? It's and the book pulls them together beautifully. Thank you. It is a masterful celebration of our birds and our culture, and your storytelling is assisted by a fabulous team of illustrators. So can you tell us a little bit about the process of pulling it together and about working with the illustrators and just some description on the illustrations throughout, because they're very, very beautiful.
Yeah, they are gorgeous. And there were an amazing diverse group of illustrators. So there's some very beautiful, detailed black and white portraits of birds, and then more sort of watercolour ones. So it's always something different when you flip the page, which is lovely. And I can't take credit for pulling together this amazing team of illustrators. That was really spearheaded by Lynn Freeman, who was also at Forest and Bird, and she has a very long-standing and deep connection with the arts world in New Zealand. And so she had ideas of the kind of artists that she wanted to bring into this project, who were not just amazing artists, but also people who were dedicated to conservation of birds and sort of bringing these birds to life with the aim of raising awareness about them. And so she and Penguin Random House had a list of people who then contributed their works. We did have some gaps to fill because, of course, with 80 different birds, it's hard to find, you know, all of the different birds already existing, in especially those kind of underbirds who people maybe don't see as often. So there were a couple commissioned as well, and yeah, then some that we just sort of found.
I see. Yeah. Okay, so you were able to draw on existing images. Mm. They're not all new images for the book. That's interesting. I hadn't picked up on that. Yeah. They're beautifully reproduced. So the book is visually delightful as well as the storytelling, listeners. So just so that you appreciate that. It's actually pretty serious, isn't it? Like, so as well as the fun and the of this competition and the and of its history, the purpose is to raise awareness of conservation status of New Zealand birds. Talk to us about that, Ellen.
Yeah, so more than 80% of our native birds are either at risk or threatened with extinction, which is a lot. And there's research which shows that New Zealanders actually think that our nature and our environment is doing pretty well, when that's really not the case. And so behind the kind of, you know, humour and the memes and the trash talking, there is this more serious message of, the fact that our birds, many of them, are not doing well. And so when you flick through the book, you'll see they have a little tag which tells you whether they are in serious trouble, in some trouble, or doing okay. Or if you go on the Bird of the Year website, same thing. You can kind of scroll through and get a sense for how many are in real trouble. So it's not just, I guess, a celebration of the birds that we love to see in our backyards, the tui and the piwakawaka, but also a chance to get to know some of those birds which are in real trouble and need more of that love and attention.
Is it still controversial about the bat? You know, like, honestly, just saying, yeah. Because when I said that I was doing this interview with a group of friends who were in the business world and love New Zealand nature and things, the first thing they said, but what about the bat? You know, and so I think that was 2022, was it? I can't remember.
Yeah, 2021.
2021. Yeah. So is the bat still included? Do we still think the bat is a bird?
Well, I think from a scientific standpoint, no, it does. It's a mammal, but definitely something that still inspires lots of feedback whenever you mention, oh, I'm involved in Bird of the Year.
What about the bat?
Yeah, you put the bat in. I didn't put the bat in. That was someone else. But I think that really came about because we only have two living native bat species and they face many of the same threats that our native birds do. So because there's only two, never going to be Bat of the Year, but it was really seen as a nice gesture to
solidarity.
Exactly. Solidarity. And then from a te ao Māori perspective, manu, which is the te reo Māori word for bird, does actually technically mean any winged creature. So a bat is a manu, te manu rongonui o te tau, could be a bat or a moth or a bird.
Oh, yeah. My God, you're getting mothy here. Don't get mothy. That's going to be really difficult, isn't it, if we get mothy? But, you know, those conservation messages equally apply, don't they? Mm. And so from that, and that is a cool reflection on manu as well. So thank you very much for that. Ellen, I wanted to just also talk about the fact that politics gets involved here. Okay, so our politicians get involved. And so are you Do you deliberately cultivate that? What's the status of that at the moment? How, because, I mean, the whole genesis, the whole idea kind of grew out of reflecting our voting system, didn't it? So talk to me about what you're doing to kind of try and stimulate our politicians to get involved and kind of participation at that high level in the competition.
Yeah, so that really dates back to the very early days of the competition. There was a former political journalist, Helen Bain, who very well connected in politics. And I think in 2006, literally every leader of a major party endorsed a bird, which is incredible, you know, support from across all sides of the political spectrum. And that has continued, not every year. If it's an election year, we might say, we're just going to leave the politicians alone. They can go and do their own thing. But inevitably, they do want to get involved in the fun. And sometimes that does involve Forest and Bird reaching out and saying, here are some options we think, you know, these ones would be good for you. Or sometimes it's just they find a bird of their own volition and want to champion it.
Right. Okay. Well, that kind of genesis of how the story started, do you want to just take us right back to the beginning of that and talk about the Radio New Zealand and the controversy there around the bird sound on Radio New Zealand? I don't know whether all listeners are listeners to radio, but talk us through that.
Yeah, so for more than 50 years now, Radio New Zealand has played a daily bird call ahead of the morning news. And in 2005, the Morning Report hosts sort of floated the idea that maybe it was time to get rid of the bird call. And
madness.
Yes, well, it did provoke a very strong reaction. And they had, I think it was like 1,600 emails come in the space of an hour, with people saying, don't get rid of the bird. But also people saying, I love this bird so much, or sharing their bird stories. And Michael Szabo, who was the communications manager at Forest and Bird at the time, he was sort of listening to this, and he'd come across the concept of a Bird of the Year competition when he'd been working in Europe. There were a few countries which were part of BirdLife International, which is a big global bird charity, who ran their own little competitions for their members. And so he thought, we should do a Bird of the Year here, but we'll make it open to anyone, because it's not just Forest and Bird members who love our birds. It's everyone, clearly, from this reaction.
No, that is, it is a beautiful genesis story, and it does kind of speak to, you know, birds are our animal, aren't they, in Aotearoa? You know, obviously there are the creatures of the sea as well, but the birds, we feel a particular affinity to them. So Bird of the Year competition. Folks, get your copy of the book. It's published by Penguin. It's available at bookstores nationwide. And in fact, get two, because it makes a fabulous gift for any occasion. It's perfect for even a late Father's Day. And get online to vote this year as well. Type Bird of the Year into your search engine. That's right, isn't it, Alan?
Yep, should come up.
But all Bookends listeners, beware, okay? Your loyalty is expected, and we need a voting block behind the Nutu Pare, which is the little rye-billed, what kind of bird is it? Rye-billed?
A rye-bill, yeah.
Just a rye-bill. Yeah. Okay, so it's got a wee cloud-breasted, quirky-billed, braided river nesting taonga, and we know it's hard to align yourself with anything endorsed by PM Luxon, but our birds are something that we need to be bipartisan about. So get behind the Rye Bill. Bookends voters, thank you so much, Ellen, for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Sinead Corcoran-Dye is known to many as a journalist and social media content creator covering lifestyle, mental health and parenting. She has just published a memoir entitled It Nearly Killed Me, But I Love You, which talks honestly, heartbreakingly and frequently hilariously about pregnancy, new motherhood, postnatal depression and it explores friendships, marriage, and grief for the loss of her mother along the way. Sinead joins me over Zoom to discuss the book, which she dedicates to all new mothers. It's kind of her version of bringing over a lasagna, she says. Tēnā koe, Sinead. Thanks for joining us. I hope you're recovered from COVID okay.
I haven't.
Oh, no.
And I'm so sorry, but I was like, I can't reschedule again. And I thought, maybe is this being like a mother that's like every time you get sick, like, that just chips something away at your body and it never returns. So maybe this is my voice forever.
I hope not. But yeah, that whole thing of motherhood just meaning perpetual bugs, completely settle in, babe. It's going to be like that. So now, trigger alert, Sinead. I need to start by admitting that I'd never thought about what constant morning sickness would actually be like to experience, right? I've had a couple of kids, had some morning sickness, knew that that happened to people, but hadn't really given it much thought. And I can't remember what it's called. It sounds like a Harry Potter incantation, this disease, doesn't it? But can you fill listeners in properly about this horror?
Yes. So it's called hyperemesis gravidarum, and nobody knew of it. And like, I'm glad you don't know of it and know how to say it. I wish I didn't know how to say it. But no one knew of it until Kate Middleton got it, and then it became something we cared about because she's thin and beautiful, I guess. Then we cared about it. And I got it. I believe it's genetic. And I know now, which I only recently learnt because one of my mum's friends in her 20s just came into my life, and she said that my mum had been sick right throughout her pregnancy with me. But they didn't know it was hyperemesis. Maybe it wasn't, but I feel like it probably was, because as well, my only female cousin, she had it really bad. So it's just a family curse, I assume, like mental illness also ricocheting down my family line. And so basically, I wouldn't even say it's like morning sickness. I mean, it is, but it's more like the worst hangover you've ever had every day for 9 months. Like the hangovers where like, you just feel grotty and grimy and greasy and like yuck, and you feel so sick, and so you want to throw up, but then you throw up, you don't feel any better. There's no respite from it, and it's just hideous. And it, most of the time, for most people, it will like dissipate throughout your pregnancy. Like it gets better by 12 weeks or 20 weeks. But when it's my life, things never get better. But mine actually got worse. And as we were talking about before we started, I was saying my daughter is ginormous. She's like the BFG. Like, she's very tall. And so the bigger she got in my 5 foot body, I think the more it pushed on my organs, so the sicker I felt. So it was just like...
It sounds unbelievable, and it does sound like a curse. The name of it, as I say, is very Harry Potter-esque, but it's only part of your experience of postnatal depression, isn't it? It's not at all the full picture. And I wonder if you could just give listeners like a summary run through of the major life and mental health challenges that you faced and kind of continue to face to be well and show up okay as a mum for Vivi?
Yeah, so basically when I got pregnant, I've been on medications for mental health stuff for like 5 years. So my daughter's 2 now, so 3 years before that. And for like anti-anxiety medications, antidepressants, a whole cluster of little pills that I take. But apparently none of them were ideal for pregnancy. They said they weren't pregnancy safe. I think now in hindsight, they'd be like, you know what, they'd be okay. But at the time, they were like, we'll pull you off everything, see how you go, and then if you get bad, we can put you back on all the meds. I was very bad because I was so physically sick. So then I think it became hard for people to know, like, is she getting mentally bad or is this physically sick? So no one ever put me back on my meds. Shade to the public mental health system. It's an incredible system, but it's very under-resourced, so it's no wonder, you know what I mean, that happened. And so I was medication-free for the worst 9 months of my life, which is probably not an ideal time to be yanked off all your ECSRIs. And then I was sort of crawling to the finish line of birth because I was like, I just got to get this baby out. I'll stop throwing up. I can have a margarita, a Subway, like everything will be fine. Not realizing, and again, I feel like this probably should have been on the medical system to realize that when this woman, a woman is so, so sick and so broken, can't stop crying, she's lost half her body weight, which is not what you're supposed to do when you're pregnant, then to give birth and be handed a tiny screaming baby who doesn't sleep, therefore she won't sleep, like she's probably not going to bounce back super quick. That's actually probably going to be pretty dangerous. But and particularly without being put on medication, even at that last hurdle to sort of cushion that landing. But I think we were all kind of trying to put out fires of how sick I was that no one really thought what's going to happen then when we're like, here's your baby, now good luck.
Yeah. Is there, in all of that context, is there a, you know, like there is a message, I think, in this book that's universal, because but motherhood is hard for everyone, right? And it's an especially hard job emotionally. But for you, it's just so, it sounds, and for many other women too, I think, it sounds just so much harder. So this book's going to be especially affirming for people who are doing it super hard. But I did feel like there was something kind of more universal in it as well for all mothers, even those that aren't like having that brutality of experience and that you did. Could, do you want to just kind of reflect on that a little bit?
The messaging for all mums.
Yeah, yeah. Or and also, you know, just, yeah, just that whole thing of how hard you had it, but it's hard for everyone, how, and how you think about that.
Yeah, totally. It's like, it's, this was my first child and this was like walking through flames of hell. But you don't, a mother, like if, she, if a woman's pregnant reading this or just had a baby and she's not in the absolute flames of hell that I am, that doesn't mean that she should be having a great time or she is having a great time in comparison, or like, or if she's reading it thinking, oh, I'm actually not feeling great, like I'm not feeling super bonded to this baby. I don't feel great in myself. I don't, this doesn't feel normal, but it doesn't look like what that happened to that girl, Shanae, because that's like obscene. So I must be fine. Like if you take anything away from this, like don't let it be that, because that does not mean that you are fine. You probably are, like you'll be fine. But if it doesn't look like how I looked, that's good, because I would hate it too. But that doesn't mean that that everything's okay for you, you can't complain or you shouldn't talk about it or you shouldn't ask for help. Like there's so many shades of not good or not okay. And so the word, yeah, my biggest fear would be somebody to read it thinking like, oh, well, it's not as bad as her, so I shouldn't say anything to anyone. Say everything to everyone, because that's what gets mums better. That's what keeps mums safe. That's what keeps children safe.
Yeah, beautiful. And for me, I guess what I found in it was just a reminder about taking mental health seriously, full stop, like really paying attention amid all the noise of life, whether that's motherhood or just all the noise of life, to whether you're actually okay in it all. Because as you say, you got a bit lost in that. You're dealing with the physical and not certain of whether your emotional reactions are normal. But if you're not okay, you're not okay. It doesn't matter whether they're normal or not, right?
Totally. And as well, I think, and like when I just said what I don't want people to take from this, what I do want people to take from this, particularly partners of new mums or pregnant mums, is like zoom out, look at who's in her life. Because for me, I didn't have, as readers will know, I didn't have my mum. I was one of the first of my friends to have a baby, particularly because my husband was much older than me, and so I was living an older life, I suppose. And so I think it's important to zoom out, like, does she have a mum? Does she have sisters with babies? Does she have friends with babies? If not, keep a closer eye on her, because then if she does start to take a turn or she's not doing quite right, where's the mum looking at her being like, that's not how my daughter looks, it's not how I looked when I had a baby? And if there are no women or mothers in her lives and she's starting to look a bit not great, run down the road to a neighbor, like go, think like, I saw a mum who lives five houses down, run, knock on her door and say, are you a mum? I think you're a mum. Could you come look at my wife?
Or come talk. Mom? Yeah, come talk to her.
I need a mum to just check this new mum and say, is this normal? Does she look okay to you?
Yeah.
And if in doubt, take her to a GP. It's $40. Better safe than sorry. And I just think it's so important that we zoom out. We look at these mums, especially, you know, in a holistic way, especially mums in rural areas. Like, the maternal mental health system is stretched enough. Like, and I'm in Auckland CBD and Point Chevalier. What is the state of it in, like, Northland, you know?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. That's a really good shout out. You've started and become an ambassador for a couple of charities and working somewhere in this space, haven't you? It'd be great to hear about those.
Yeah, totally. So after I had Viv and I was sent to the clink, the Starship Mum and Baby unit, a friend of a friend put in a referral for us to a charity called Napkin, which funds night nannies for mums who are going through postnatal distress. It was like, you know, postnatal anxiety, depression, psychosis, and who desperately need to catch up on sleep. Like, none of us get enough sleep. We could all do with a night nanny. But particularly these mums who, you know, are sicker than sick and having to get up through the night for babies, and we know how fundamental sleep is to any sort of recovery or healing. And so they put a referral in for us, which was incredible, particularly because we had two other children. The woman who runs it, Hannah, said, here's three nights of a free nanny. And I later found out that the charity only funds one night, but she had paid out of her own money for me to have more. And it was just so lovely. And then I did what I always do with things in life is, then the next day I'm like, right, I'm taking over this. I'm going to be CEO. Can I please work for your charity and spread the good word, because I think I'm some disciple. So I asked if I could get involved, and she was like, you've barely got home from this site.
Yeah, some boundaries here, Sinead, some boundaries around self-care, you know.
She was like, the nanny's still at your house, like, go to sleep. And I'm like, no, like, I've set up a spreadsheet, like, this, we're going to send out PR packages, but this is just what I'm like. But I forced myself upon them, and now I'm the New Zealand ambassador of Napkin, which basically means just do what I do best/worst, which is not shut up about anything that's happened to me, in the hopes that it will get some mum to also not shut up. She'll tell a friend, they'll tell a friend. And again, that's how we'll...
So if you're listening in, Napkin is the name of the charity, and go online and register your support if postnatal depression matters to you. Look, the book's tone is super irreverent, and I think people can get some of your vivacity from our serious topic so far. Stylistically, it's very conversational, kind of social media casual. To give listeners a taste of that, I wondered if you could just read us a brief section. And I picked out from either a tiny curated selection of all the things I feel guilty about, which is a very hilarious chapter, or wanking at baby sensory class. So do you want to give us a reading just to close out the interview? And before you do that, I'll just say that thank you so much. The book is It Nearly Killed Me, But I Love You by Sinead Corcoran-Dye. It's published by Moa Press, and this is Sinead reading us out.
Thank you. I will do wanking at baby sensory class, because I just feel like you just probably don't get chapter titles like that much in your travels. Okay. So if you're not aware of baby sensory class, I'm sure you are. It's like the singing, jangling musical instruments crap that just melts your brain. But we all do it with our first children, I believe, and then never again. Okay. Excuse my voice. Wanking at baby sensory class. Post that teeny tiny blip of P&D, of course. I loved the first couple of months of maternity leave. We did it all, me and Viv. Space class, baby sensory, swimming lessons, walks to the French bakery. I forked out on annual passes for both Kelly Talton's and Auckland Zoo, which I told Stu would be such a money saver because we'll be there every week. All the mums would sit in a circle at baby sensory, with our babies in our laps, mine looking utterly shell-shocked and in tears because she's sensitive to noise like me, and we'd sing and sign the corn song. What is the corn song, you ask? It's this little ditty that extols the joy of the sun and the moon shining and beaming down on us. Lovely, lovely, wholesome, lovely. But then we get to the next line, which involves greeting the corn, marvelling at its strength and basking in the joy of it feeding us. Yum, right? Who doesn't love corn? Except when you get to this line in the song, you have to mime the shape of a corn cob, which in practice looks like you're wanking a corn cob off. And you must restrain yourself from sniggering and making eye contact with any of the other parents, because what if they're not thinking the same thing? But they are. And they're also thinking, what happened to us? We used to be successful career women in our 30s, long lunching with clients and commanding boardrooms. And now we are sitting in a circle, wanking invisible corn.
I'm going to have to stop you there, Sinead. Thank you so much. Just a taste of things to come, folks. Pick up It Nearly Killed Me, But I Love You by Sinead Corcoran-Dye, and go online and check out Napkin. Thank you.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Surviving the Holocaust is Helen Shamroth's account of growing up with parents who experienced and overcame the horrors of that time. It started off as 18 fictional connected stories, but Helen then explored the many facets of her parents' lives back in wartime Poland and in Melbourne, where they immigrated to in 1949, and discovered that she was best to tell it as creative non-fiction. Helen is an arts writer and consultant, a curator, and a visual artist herself. In 2005, she was made an officer of the New Zealand Order of Merit. She's been on the Arts Board of Creative New Zealand, and she's had a very active career in the arts. Helen, it feels like you were compelled to tell this story and you were finding a way into it.
Well, I'll tell you, you talked about fictional stories. This did start off as fiction, but it ended up as memoir. So those 18 stories, originally, I was really trying to interpret some artworks that I was making. And the artworks were Holocaust references in them. And I started making notes, and the notes became phrases and sentences and paragraphs, and I ended up with three fictional stories based on my parents' life, on their lives. And it was one of those magical things. I was on the Arts Board of Creative New Zealand at the time, as was Dame Fiona Kidman. She wasn't Dame then. And we were talking after a meeting, having a convivial little debrief about our lives. And she asked me what I was doing, and I said, I mentioned these three stories. She said, send them to me. Well, I sent them to her, and then I said to her, should I go and do a class if I'm going to start writing these things? She said, no, just keep writing. And so I did. But I kept writing on and off for a very long time, because that was back in 2002. And in between, I was earning a living and I was doing all the things that one does in the arts. You've got to work pretty hard to earn a living. And so at the end of every project, I would have a go at this and see if a publisher was interested, and they weren't quite there. Eventually, I found Amsterdam Publishers, and they specialise in Holocaust literature. So for me, that was where I did the hard work. And it was still fiction at that stage, until I showed my family what I was about to publish. We were all set, just about all set to go. And they said, you can't do this to our story. This is our story. And I said, do you know what? It's a hard one because some of the stories, as you know, are pretty in-depth and pretty grim. I said, I'll give it a go. And if it works, I'll publish what you're asking me to. And my publisher did this, a very slow response to one of my emails, and said, yes, go ahead. So, yes. It ended up being nonfiction. So we're talking about creative nonfiction here.
Yes, because, you know, even it was probably a good way to work your way into the stories by initially fictionalizing them, and then as you worked out how you were going to approach each of those 18 segments, because it's still in 18 segments, really, isn't it?
It is still 18 stories, and they kind of stand on their own, but they're all connected.
And 18 is, there's a reason for that, isn't there?
There is a reason. I'll explain it to you. The word 18 in Hebrew is chai, and it consists of two letters, a chet and a yud. The number 18 has exactly the same letters. Chet is 8, yud is 10. So 18 is connected to life. And you may even have heard it when people say l'chaim, when they're toasting somebody, that's to life. Mm. And so the connection was there. I remember talking with my father when I was a child about numbers. He was heavily into numbers, and he would talk about it. And then my mother made a reference to a 7 being an important number. So I knew that there was this whole study of numbers that I came to later as an adult. I learned a lot more about it. And I don't know, the numbers stick with me. I've been into numbers over the years. My daughters and my grandson are into numbers as well in their own way. And so it's like it's come through from my father. It made sense to me. It made sense to me. And I knew it would be a bit puzzling for some. And I really workshopped it with my sister and with various ones, and I stayed with it.
Yeah. Well, it's life that they celebrated in their survival, wasn't it? And how they lived their lives after that.
It was so much about living for the present. And my father would say, you can't undo yesterday, and you have no idea what will be tomorrow, so just make today a good day. And it's not a bad philosophy, actually.
No, it's a good one, a very good one. Helen, at one stage you say in the book, guilt has been my companion for decades. Why guilt?
I never really worked out why. I just had this little thing. I felt guilty. There was a layer of guilt in my relationship with my mother, which was pretty good under the circumstances. I didn't think it was a bad relationship, but she made me feel guilty. Or I felt guilty because that's what I thought she was doing or saying. And it kind of stuck. It stuck until, you know, my 50s maybe. You know, it took me a long time to unpick it. And I wonder now whether it might have been something to do that we were alive.
Mm. Yeah, and you were taking for granted the life that you had.
Yes, and of course there is this thing called survivor guilt. I didn't think that we had that. But when I looked back and I was writing, I realised, oh, yes, we did. We definitely did.
Mm.
It didn't show up in a negative way. It showed up in a, I'm going to prove to them that it's worth living.
Yeah, that everything they'd been through, you weren't taking for granted that you were actually going to live the life that they wanted you to.
Yeah.
They had different experiences. I mean, it was all horrific, but your father was in the camps and your mother managed to evade them by being taken in by people and passing off as being, you know, Polish, not Jewish.
She was blessed with blonde hair, blue eyes. She spoke impeccable Polish with no trace of Yiddish. It was the no trace of Yiddish that, you know, that was part of her survival. And so, yeah, and she was beautiful and she was charming and she was a flirt and she had survivor written all over her.
Mm. And your father, I mean, I'm skipping over heaps of stuff here, but
I know.
His way of, people have to read the book, his way of surviving was so dramatic, and it took you a long time before you knew the actual details of how he'd escaped.
We didn't know our parents' stories of survival. My sister's 6 years younger than me. She was actually born in Australia. And I was born in Poland. So I knew stuff instinctively, you know, like when your mother says to you, eat up everything on your plate because you don't know when you're going to get another meal. That was for real when we were leaving Poland.
Mm.
That was definitely for real in 1946. And I knew that my sister never had that pressure on her. So, yeah, so I was curious to know stuff, everything, you know, like any child, why, and why. And I was shut down a lot. And then later my sister was shut down too. Little things would slip out. There'd be things that they would say that suddenly they'd let something out, you know, the cat out of the bag. They'd say something that they hadn't intended to say. And I remember my mother shouting at my father, how dare he say stuff in front of a young child.
Mm.
I mean, that was how it went. So it took years before they finally felt that they could say the odd thing to us. I suppose they'd been worn down a bit. And then there were, and I explain in the book about the instances of them actually doing recordings. And it was the recorded words that gave me a lot of my stories. There are parts there, they're not quite 100%, but they're very close to their voices in what they said. And it was something that for us, it was just extraordinary to find it. And we'd keep finding more when we delved more. For different reasons. My sister was making a film, I was writing my book, and we delved and we'd read stuff that we'd forgotten that was there.
Mm.
You know, and I did a lot of transcription and still a lot of it didn't stick for, you know, the length, because they were very comprehensive stories that they told when they finally told them.
Yes, I guess as they got older, maybe, and, you know, there was more available in terms of people doing research into survivors' stories, that they were then encouraged by that to know that they'd be safe telling their stories, or I don't know if that's a factor.
I did ask at one point when I talked a lot with my sister. You can imagine we were doing these parallel projects, and I was helping her with the film, and then she was helping me, talking to me and saying, no, I wouldn't say it like that. And so we engaged a lot, and we kept probing and we kept trying to understand. And I'm not sure I'll ever understand some of it, but I've got a much better idea, and I realised that other people talking didn't necessarily mean that they would.
No, true.
They just shut it down so much.
And that's their prerogative, isn't it?
Oh, if you're going to get nightmares and migraines and be sick, you know, have a heart attack, whatever, because you're reliving horrors, of course you shut it down. I mean, I totally respect that, and I have done for a very long time. I just wanted to know.
Of course, of course. Yeah. As you say, so many hints, so many slips of showing you that there was stuff in behind the facade that there was there. It must have been at times really frustrating. And you and your sister went over and visited all those relevant sites. And that must have given you another understanding as well.
It gave us an understanding, and it also raised a whole lot more questions that could never be answered. You know, like there was something, some instances, like visiting the Sobieski Castle in Zlochev, which is the town that my mother came from. When we were there at the castle, we knew that our grandmother was there, buried there, and most probably my mother's first husband, because both of my parents lost a spouse before they met. And you go to a place like that and you listen to the historians talking, and it doesn't gel with what was in Mum's transcript. And I'm thinking, well, he's got that from somebody else who's done a transcript, and we've got it from directly from Mum. And, you know, it wasn't the same. And there was the tug. Will we ever know the actual truth? And my mother did an extraordinary description of her mother's life and death. She actually told it. I don't know how she did it. She did it to an interviewer. She never did it to us, but to the interviewer. And I grabbed that whole story about my grandmother. It was the only grandparent story I had.
Mm.
And so I felt that she would have been pretty accurate with that. I think that would have stayed with her. And, we were at odds with this historian.
Yeah, I think from the way you write about it, I can't imagine that she would have forgotten or fudged or you know, changed the facts at all in that instant. It must have been interesting because your sister's film, which I've watched on Netflix, Man on a Bus, I absolutely recommend doing that. You know, it does tell the story of your father, but it was really a story about your mother and the relationship she had with this man on the bus. But yours is a different take on, because it is your parents as you're the two, the father and the mother, and their backgrounds and experiences. So there's these two parallel stories that, you know, uphold each other. But that must have been an interesting process for you working on your book while she was doing her research for her film.
Some of the research we did together, like we did when we went to Poland and Ukraine, because parts of Poland, that, like Zlochev, where my mother came from, and Lviv, which is now Lviv, are now in Ukraine, but they were part of Poland back then. And so we had this very interesting trip, and I think I talk about that a little bit in the book too. And what was fascinating was that when I said to Eve, come with me, you know, because I had discovered that there was going to be this memorial unveiled. I said, come. And she thought about it and she said, yes, I will come. And she ended up getting some really remarkable footage there, which was coincidental, and that we were at that stage of just trying to put it all together.
Well, I think you've done a remarkable job, and it just adds to our understanding. For you, it's a hugely personal thing, and it's a real taonga for your family, for your whānau. But for us, the general reader, it adds to our understanding and knowledge. So thank you, Helen, for sharing your family's stories in this book.
Thank you, Lauren. It's lovely talking to you.
The book is called 18 for Life. It's by Helen Shamroth, and it's published by Amsterdam Press.
Amsterdam Publishers.
Yes, I can. And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.